Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Gyadim Sulongkumar, and I'm the host of this channel. Today, I'm here with Dr. Stephen Harris to talk about his book, Buddhist Ethics and Bodhisattva Path, Santideva on Virtue and Well-Being. And this is a very interesting work, which discusses the work of Santideva, specifically on the aspect of virtue and the aspect of well-being. And the author actually delves into one of the work by Santideva. So this is something which we will actually be exploring on today. So let me straight away go to the author himself. So Dr. Harris, can you tell us something about yourself? Yeah.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I'm really glad to be here. I did my PhD at a philosophy department in the US at the University of New Mexico. It's one of the rare departments that does Indian philosophy seriously in the philosophy department itself. So I was very lucky to study there. And then for the last 10 years, I've been teaching Western, but also Indian philosophy at the Leiden University in the Netherlands. So at the Netherlands, we have a Dutch language program, but we also started an English language BA program that's been very popular with students. And we do Chinese, Asian, Islamic, and African philosophy alongside Western philosophy in the program. So I'm really happy and very proud to be a part of it. And so the electives I offer, my research has primarily focused on Buddhist moral philosophy, particularly Indian Buddhist moral philosophy. And so the electives I offer discuss authors like Shantideva, who my book is on, but also Buddhaghosa, Chandrakirti, and many of the other great Indian Buddhist thinkers.
Yeah, interesting. So, I mean, this is a specific work on Santideva and one of its writings. So, can you tell me what got you interested in this particular person and work? Yeah.
Yeah, so Santideva, we actually know very little historically about his life. Scholars place him at the 7th or 8th century CE, and I think he probably lived in northern India. Traditional accounts that a lot, most scholars accept is that he lived at the great Indian University of Nalanda. And I was introduced to his thought as a philosopher. I was doing an MA at the University of Hawaii, which is another place that does Asian philosophy seriously in the philosophy department. And because it was the Buddhist, I was gotten interested in Buddhist philosophy, and because it was the course on offer, I did a seminar on this text, on Shantideva's Introduction to the Practices of Awakening, with one of my teachers there, Roy Parrott. And so we focused primarily, as a lot of philosophers do, on the 9th chapter, the very difficult chapter on wisdom, and looked at Shantideva's engagements with the various other Indian Buddhist and non-Buddhist thinkers, and worked through this slowly in seminar style. But we also spent a shorter amount of time, but a little bit of time on the rest of the text. And I found myself just really fascinated with Shantideva's deconstructions of our ordinary conception of value, much of which happens outside of the 9th chapter. Even though I discussed the 9th chapter in my book, I felt myself really particularly called to the rest of the text. So then I went to New Mexico for my dissertation, studied various things. At that time, there was some really good work on Buddhist ethics, but, you know, this was about 15 years ago. And there were really only a few philosophers writing out philosophy departments on Buddhist ethics. And so I was really reading people like Damien Keown, and especially actually Charles Goodman, who had started ethics as a philosopher at that point, that really kind of encouraged me. And I thought, okay, this is actually a really interesting description of happiness and virtue, and you know, it belongs in philosophy departments. So I ended up doing my dissertation on a related topic on Shantideva, Shantideva and moral demandingness, and then ended up moving to the Netherlands. And then over time, you know, my thoughts progressed. And with the current study, I wanted to look more closely at the structure of Shantideva's arguments in the text, and the book came out of a result of that.
Yeah, quite interesting. So can you tell us something about Shantideva? What kind of school did he belong to, and what kind of things that he usually kind of thought about and wrote on? Yeah.
So he was, as I said, we know almost nothing historically about him, but we're fortunate to have inherited two of his texts that are still extant and now have been translated. My study focuses on the shorter, the more influential of these. And so this is a conservative translation of it. The one I tend to use is the Introduction to the Practices of Awakening. A lot of times you see a longer translation, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is also kind of gives you a sense of what the text is. And so the topic of the text is the Bodhisattva, who in Buddhism is the being of infinite compassion, who makes this outrageous vow to eliminate all the suffering of all beings. So this places Shantideva in the Mahayana school. The ideas of the Bodhisattva come from mainstream Buddhism. The historical Buddha himself was said to be a Bodhisattva. But in Mahayana Buddhism, Shantideva is about the 8th century, and Mahayana Buddhism begins probably about 800, 900 years before that. So he's already part of a long, rich intellectual tradition. But they place more and more emphasis on the Bodhisattva and start to develop the idea that not just exemplary persons like the Buddha, but ordinary persons too should start to train in this path. And then he's usually placed in the Majjhimaka school. The Mahayana school develops two kind of sister philosophical schools, the Yogacara and the Majjhimaka. And so Majjhimaka is distinctive in its radicalization of the core Buddhist idea of the absence of any metaphysical self, what's sometimes referred to as no self. And they radicalize this to say not just persons, but all phenomena, anything that exists is empty of intrinsic existence or essence. The Sanskrit term is svabhava. And then for Shantideva and many of the great ethicists working from the Majjhimaka tradition, is actually realization of metaphysical emptiness that liberates one from the negative emotions and allows one to attain happiness and then finally nirvana. And so Shantideva, one of the things I kind of try to stress in my book, this isn't kind of the central purpose of the book, but I think sometimes people, it's easy to misunderstand the Mahayana movement as being in opposition to the mainstream and the early Buddhist movement. And of course, as Buddhist philosophy develops, it splinters into multiple philosophical schools. And indeed, Shantideva and Majjhimaka disagree with some of those schools. But Shantideva and actually all the major Indian Mahayana thinkers accept all the basic tenets from early Buddhism, ideas like metaphysical selflessness, the unsatisfactoriness of ordinary existence, dependent origination. And so their contribution is to, I think, in a philosophical vein, you can think of them, sometimes I think of Shantideva as sort of systematically beginning to think through some of the ethical and psychological consequences of the early Buddhist view. So one of the themes of my book is trying to show how these early Buddhist tenets and these early Buddhist ideas reoccur over and over again and are deployed in different ways in his text.
I mean, quite an elaborate explanation about Shantideva and, you know, the way you got interested in it and how your book delves into his work. So coming specifically to the chapters, the opening chapter is about virtue theory and how you kind of, you know, bring out the aspect of the virtue being the central component of well-being in Shantideva's work. And you also discuss these two components called the perfections and the pathological emotions. So can you kind of explain what does this mean?
Yeah. So My previous work on Shantideva focused on a variety of topics, but particularly I was interested in this idea of moral demandiness. So moral demandiness is the concern that a particular ethical theory makes unfairly high requirements of its adherents. And so I got interested philosophically in Shantideva because it seemed as though, on the one hand, as a Mahayana Buddhist, he seems to place enormously high prescriptions on those who follow this path, develop limitless compassion, work tirelessly for the sake of all sentient beings. And at the same time, this is a common Mahayana view, but he is just so explicit about it. He claims that the Bodhisattva path is self-beneficial to all types of persons, to those outside of the path, to the extent that they accept aspects of the path, to early Bodhisattvas, and all the way up. And so I thought, well, you know, how on earth does this go together? You have this kind of radicalized conception of altruism, which seems as though, and sometimes I think the Shantideva's guide, I'll just call it the guide to give a short title to it, Shantideva's guide can be misread this. Sometimes you see it as the Bodhisattva sacrificing his or her own well-being for the sake of others. And it just seems like he just really explicitly denies this and says, no, compassion, bodhicitta, which is the root motivation to become a fully enlightened Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings, radical giving, giving oneself, giving all one's possessions, these are self-beneficial. So I kind of took this as a philosophical puzzle. And the answer is the standard Mahayana answer. It's not distinctive to Shantideva. He just gives a really beautiful, elegant presentation of it. At least a central component of the answer, I should say, and that's that we have these two sets of mental states. We have the, what I'm translating in the Sanskrit is klesha. In the text, I'm translating it as pathological emotion. Pathological, this is Jay Garfield's influence. He convinced me to do this. Pathological, pathos, meaning suffering. So pathological, what causes or constitutes suffering. These are the mental states of delusion, reification of self, craving, anger, jealousy, arrogant pride, and an unstable mind. And throughout the text, in sort of bewildering detail, Shantideva articulates what the pathological emotions are and how they impoverish one's existence. Socially, mentally, they're emotionally painful, they destabilize the mind. As a part of his Buddhist heritage, he believes in rebirth. So one is reborn into negative results as a result of them. And the solution is to develop what I talk about as the virtuous mental states. And usually he uses this term of perfection, but also there's some other virtuous mental states which aren't perfections, but are just as important to him. And so this is things like compassion, generosity, patience, and wisdom. In fact, my study focuses primarily upon those four virtuous mental states. And then he has some others as well, ethical discipline and meditative concentration, mindfulness and introspection. And the virtuous mental states stabilize the mind. They act as the antidotes to the pathological emotions. They eliminate them. And so they protect their possessor from the root of all suffering, the pathological emotions. And again, this is really distinctive to Shantideva's strategy in the guide. He puts a lot of emphasis on other regarding virtuous mental states or virtuous emotions, particularly in focusing on compassion, the wish to remove the suffering of others, and generosity. We initially think of generosity as offering all one's possessions to others, although then he also thinks of the psychological consequences of it. And so this is his solution to this philosophical puzzle that I had. Well, how do you combine this radical commitment to altruism in a way that's self-beneficial? Well, it's egoistic behavior manifested as a pathological emotions that really are suffering, cause our suffering, but really are suffering for Shantideva. And it's the various virtuous mental states, the other guardian mental states, and the other supporting virtues that eliminate them and constitute at least the well-being of at least the developing bodhisattva. And the one thing I'll mention, just to kind of introduce the overall project, and so I try to kind of lay this out in the first chapter, is a lot, I mean, there is this discussion about how to describe Shantideva's insights, whether we should call it more psychology or phenomenology, and authors who emphasize this way of describing his text quite rightly point to his focus on virtuous and afflictive qualities of mind, his continual reference to mental experience. So I also use this language and I use it as a study of Shantideva's moral psychology. But, you know, in contrast to some other Mahayana texts, like parts of Vasubandhu's Treasury of Metaphysics, Shantideva doesn't only characterize the virtuous and the afflictive mental states, but he also offers series of intellects trainings, which include argumentation to develop them. And so I think when we kind of look at that aspect, I mean, I think like a lot of the ancient Greek thinkers, like the Stoics, for instance, also going along with this, the regulation of desire and the rectification of desire, replacing self-interested desire with bodhicitta and compassion, motivational states directed towards others' benefits. This is such a reoccurring emphasis of the text, but I think we also have to think of it as providing the study of virtuous character. And this is why I use that language of virtue. So a virtue here, first of all, just in terms of mental experience, you can call it virtue because this is human excellence and it's well-being conducive. But also when we think of virtue as a habitual disposition to respond excellently in all relevant situations, this is what Shantideva is trying to accomplish. Not he's interested in action, but not limiting his account to action, but also really essentially for him that we respond excellently mentally to whatever circumstance comes out. So I think what we end up with is this really powerful characterization of human excellence that where do we place it in terms of a cross-cultural philosophical conversations. I think kind of the virtuous, the sage of the Confucian tradition, Aristotle's virtuous, the man of practical wisdom. I think the bodhisattva kind of needs to take its place alongside these cross-cultural studies of virtue. So that's why I use this term virtue, not in any sense in disagreement with the philosophers who very accurately pointed out that mental experience is absolutely essential to the account he gives of a morally exemplary life.
Yeah.
So that's why I try to lay out after one.
Yeah, great. I think along the way, you have also kind of touched on some of the aspect of generosity that Shantideva talk about, where it's a sense of abandoning one's, aspect of ownership and attachment that is there. So moving on, there's this topic that you talk about here, which is the aspect of anger and how Shantideva talk about anger, and where there is this two perspective of subject-oriented strategy and also the object-oriented strategy. So what is this about? Can you explain us? Yeah.
Yeah, so this is the famous chapter 6 of the guide, one of the favorite and the most influential chapters. And Shantideva's goal, so I analyze this in chapter 3 of my study. And so Shantideva takes anger to be the traditional Buddhist conception of anger, which is the wish to harm sentient beings. And I kind of mentioned, you know, if we think about kind of recognition, like kind of emotive recognition to injustice, I want to kind of flag it as a question whether Shantideva would reject that. Like when he talks about anger, he means the wish to harm another living being. That's kind of specifically what he's arguing against. And in chapter 6 of the guide, he gives a characterization of and a series of therapeutic treatments. And in this chapter, they're actually, I think all of them are arguments. This is where his argumentative voice really comes out very centrally to develop shanti. And I'm going ahead and using the usual translation of that as patience. He doesn't define it, but he characterizes it as a tranquil state of mind that's resistant to situations of animosity and distress. And so the patient mind is a mind that's free of anger. And then there's actually been a lot of philosophical attention that's been very influential to me to this chapter, because Shantideva uses such a strong argumentative voice in the chapter. And one of the things I really tried to do in the book, so there's a lot of attention that goes to a famous argument that takes place about 20 verses into the chapter, the really quick, much too quick, but the really quick summary of this argument is he argues that anger arises when we misperceive the object of our anger, the person who tries to harm us. We misperceive the enemy, the person who tries to harm us, as possessing a level of control and autonomy that they don't actually possess. So here in the background, there is this Buddhist tenet of metaphysical selflessness, but explicitly he draws attention to the supporting Buddhist metaphysical tenet of dependent origination. And we say when we take a look at the one who tries to harm us, that wasn't a freely chosen action. It arises because of that person's own causes and conditions, particularly the anger that arose in their mind. And then all of the causes and conditions that support the performance of that harmful action, causing to rise and so on. And then we'll realize, when we recognize this, we'll realize that that robust sense of agency we imputed to our enemy is illusionary. It doesn't exist. And our attitude will be, he uses the example of stomach bile. It would be irrational to be angry at stomach bile because it doesn't intend to harm us. Likewise, when we focus on the dependently originated nature of harm, anger towards enemies who seem to harm us deliberately is similarly irrational. There's been a lot of good philosophical work on this, and I cite and reference much of that in my book. But in my text, and I also explain this argument and what it takes to be Shantideva's most influential arguments, but in my book, what I really wanted to do was try to show how his arguments function in relation to the chapter as a whole, in relation to whatever else he does in the chapter, and in relation to his goals. And again, I'm drawing upon some really good sources here. I mean, sources from the Tibetan tradition, but especially 20th and 21st century commentators on them, on Shantideva. But what I think when we look at the chapter as a whole, you can see that the argument that I quickly glossed is only one of three interlocking and overlying strategies he gives in the text. And they're actually really intuitive. I mean, his arguments, I think, are philosophically interesting. But one thing I really love about this chapter is you can kind of stand back and say, well, here's the basic idea. And even though it's not obviously right, I think there's something plausible and gripping about it. So what are his three basic ideas about anger? Why is anger as irrational? Well, first of all, it's harmful. It disturbs the mind. It disrupts social relationships. It causes rebirth in a negative mental, in a negative realm. It causes emotional pain. So patience, a stable set of mind, protects us from the suffering that anger causes. And then second, this is what I call the subject-oriented strategies to eliminate anger. He gives a series of techniques, and argumentation, again, plays a key role for him, that claims that anger is irrational because it doesn't arise purely because of the situation we find ourselves in, but it arises as a result of our own subjective condition. And so here, kind of the therapeutic voice, I think, is even a bit stronger. And again, this is just straight, not even Mahayana, but mainstream Buddhism. He says, well, what's the cause or condition of anger? It's what the Sanskrit is daumanasya, sort of a neutral translation of this is mental pain. Like, I feel anger, I wish to harm another being because I have in some way been mentally wounded. I'm sort of experiencing this moment of emotional suffering, if you like, because I've been insulted or because I've been physically hurt or because I've been disappointed. And then I lash out in anger as a response. And then he sort of delves one step deeper into the causal train. He says this mental pain itself, it's caused by the frustration of desire. My desires are frustrated. are sort of mentally hurt, and then anger lashes out as a result. And so this is just kind of his presentation of basic Buddhist categories, like the 12 links of dependent origination, and also the Four Noble Truths. What's the cause of suffering? And here are the suffering of anger. Well, it's the frustration of desire, which causes mental pain. And so then what he does for a series of verses that I try to explicate in the book is he gives us various treatings to protect the mind and make it resistant to mental pain. He claims humans have great potential to overcome the ability to feel wounded by the various negative situations that life gives us. Also, I kind of want to just point out, though, I mean, something I really want to come out in the book is that even though this is therapeutic treatment, I mean, he's trying to eliminate anger, protect well-being, enhance well-being, argumentation continues here. And, you know, I can say here, well, what's the argument? Well, anger is irrational because it really doesn't have so much to do with that person out there in the world who's harming it. It's my own condition. It's that I've been hurt, you know, and again, I think we can give intuitive reactions to this. You know, I've yelled at, you know, someone I love, and then I say, well, you know, it really wasn't about you. Here's the way my day went. You know, here's what I was enjoying right now. This was my mental pain, my response to my mental pain. Shantideva wants to take exactly that common sense insight and radicalize it. Say all anger is like that, and all of it can be eventually wholly removed. And then we just combine this with where I began, what I call the object-oriented strategy. Anger arises not only because of our subjective condition, but it arises because we misperceive the object, the enemy who harms us. How do we misperceive it? Or from a narrow perspective that doesn't take all relevant factors into account, how do we misperceive it? He gives a number of different arguments and a number of different illustrations, but the one I just glossed at the beginning of my explanation is his most famous and his most worked out example. We misperceive the one harming us as possessing a level of agency and a level of autonomy that, when we really think about the dependently originated nature of reality, they never possess. And what I really want to do is combine these three, say, okay, the dependent origination argument is really important. It's philosophically interesting, but we get a richer picture of Shantideva when we say this is part of his overall strategy of protecting well-being and preparing the Bodhisattva to help others by recognizing the harmfulness of anger. So it's irrational because anger destroys our happiness. You know, recognizing that it comes from a disturbed mind that's mentally hurt, and then recognizing that there's also this objective condition, it arises because misperceiving the world and misperceiving, or I'm not realistic about the situation that I'm actually in.
Yeah, so interesting. So coming to the next question, which is about desire and joy. And where you talk about Shantideva talking about desire as a form of carving that contaminates social relationship, but also it also kind of abhors certain sense of emotional pain that is there, and also how joy plays a role in the, you know, whole of these aspects of human relation that is happening. So can you, you know, elaborate this more? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the themes throughout is desire, Shantideva's attitude towards desire. And this actually has already kind of come up, though I haven't talked about it explicitly in the podcast. It comes up in his treatment of generosity, patience, and compassion as kind of a central element of it. And again, you know, this is just completely indebted to the early Buddhist tradition where craving, impoverished forms of desire are given the explicit characterization as the cause of dukkha, or suffering. And so in terms of generosity, ultimately generosity for Shantideva is not merely giving objects to others, but of eliminating all craving towards what's already in one's possession. In terms of patience, I mentioned already in my response to the patience question, anger arises as a result of mental pain, which itself arises as a result of frustrated desire. And so to finally eliminate anger, we don't merely eliminate desire, but it's transmuted into compassion and bodhicitta, the wish to become a fully enlightened Buddha for the sake of all beings. And so I didn't mention these, but in chapter six, and I discuss a couple of these in my book, bodhicitta and compassion becomes reoccurring premises later in the chapter. And part of what he's doing, is simply arguing that anger is irrational, but part of what he is doing is trying to chip away at self-interested desire whose frustration causes mental pain and therefore anger. But where a sort of desire and it is kind of most centrally teaching in the text, at least seems to me, is chapter 8, which is a beautiful, long, complicated, and puzzling chapter. It's a puzzling chapter because its title is Meditative Concentration, or the Sanskrit of dhyana, which is a virtuous mental state of full concentration on an object of attention. And this is central to the Bodhisattva path. I think it's important to Shantideva. He quotes Mahayana sutras that discuss it in his other text. But in chapter 8 of this text, which is sort of titled Meditative Concentration, he discusses it and he frames the chapter according to it, but he doesn't really explain it in detail. And sort of philosophers and interpreters understand this different ways. But what it seems to me is the second half of that chapter is explicitly dedicated towards compassion and development of compassion in bodhicitta. These are kind of some of his most famous and most systematic meditations to develop and arguments to develop compassion. And it seems to me that these are deployed and developed by Shantideva as a way of eliminating an impoverished sense of motivation. What he talks about is arising from grasping of the self or atmagraha. So the way to kind of connect this, I came to really love this chapter, even though it was kind of a struggle to provide a reading of it. The way he develops this in that chapter is he spends the first 20-25 verses talking about all of the various dysfunctional ways human beings relate. You know, so he talks about dysfunctional aspects of romantic love, that when we don't possess the one we love, we're tortured by longing. And when we encounter them, jealousy, you know, replaces longing, and our minds are still kind of mentally tortured. And he talks about the inevitable dissatisfaction of engaging with unvirtuous people because of our domination by aggressive social emotions. So here particularly, he talks about competitiveness, but then also arrogant pride and envy or jealousy. And, you know, he sort of says, okay, well, what's the cause of this? Even in the early chapter, he says this was atmagraha, or grasping itself, which in terms of any social relationship puts us in an adversarial situation with that person, with each person seeking their own benefit from the other person. So even friendships or relations or romantic relations still fall into that impoverished framework. So there's a very famous interlude where the Bodhisattva goes into the desert or goes into the wilderness and practices various types of meditations to calm the mind, to further deconstruct the ordinary conception of craving. There's a sequence of verses where disgusting aspects of the body and actually corpses in the cemetery are contemplated. And sharp break in the chapter, about 90 really. And then he introduces a series of arguments and meditations to develop compassion. And here, I mean, one of the most famous, I'll mention two of them. The most famous argument in Shantideva's text comes from 890 to 8103, so the beginning of this section. And the really quick version of it, I give an explanation of the argument in my book, but the really quick version of it, he says that if we really contemplate somebody of all people to suffering and our wish for happiness, we realize that it's irrational to merely prioritize our own benefit. And he challenges his interlocutor to give some kind of justification for self-interested action. And then he argues that no such justification can be given. His opponent replies, well, my suffering belongs to me. And there Shantideva says we're okay, but that's only a conventional fact. There's no unified person. And so this can't provide an accurate justification. And then he moves on to another of the really famous and really influential parts of the text called the exchanging and giving meditations. And again, one of the goals they want to do is to try to treat the chapter as much as they can as a unity and encourage readers to think about the relation between this argument that he gives that appeals to metaphysical selflessness and universal vulnerability pain in relation to these more meditative, although I still think they do argumentative work, meditative contemplations that come in relation to the early parts of the chapter. So in this very famous part of the text called the exchange in self and other meditations, Bodhisattva empathetically takes the position of another. He begins by empathetically taking up the position of the person in the socially inferior position. And he mentally analyzes the kind of from the perspective of the other person. He looks back at himself and mentally observes, imaginatively observes their negative emotions they are directed towards him. So particularly their envy, which he's already analyzed in the first part of the chapter. He analyzes how painful it is for them to see him as superior to them and as uninterested in their happiness. And then he doesn't tell us, he doesn't say, okay, here's exactly what you should. But I think this is really a compassion meditation. And it's first of all, a way of imaginatively getting in the mind of the other person and sort of from a much more direct encounter, experiencing the suffering they feel, that itself can develop compassion. But also the other thing it does is it brings him himself in his ordinary position as the target of all this animosity, keeping in mind that he's vowed to become a bodhisattva and to eliminate the suffering of all beings. And so I think we can also see this as an antidote to his own arrogant pride, which he may not have even recognized, that was separating him from the other person. So what I'm hoping the book would do is, to the extent that I can, I've explained these various parts of the chapter, but also, I mean, chapter 8 is such a difficult chapter to treat as a unity. And I should mention, it's likely that parts of the chapter 8 were added at a later date. They may not have all been done by Shantideva, but however it caught to us, the more I worked with it, it seemed like there was a really beautiful organization of the chapter that we inherit, in that, first of all, we can read them as saying the anatman argument, the argument that I have no rational justification for prioritizing self-interest, is essential but not sufficient. We also have to combine this with more imaginative contemplation. And then second, these two compassion and bodhicitta techniques themselves, we can combine them with the first part of the chapter where he talked about the dysfunction of social relationships and see that these provide the bodhisattva's own antidotes to his own arrogance and his own jealousy. Because all of us are in all three of these positions of higher, social inferior, and social equal. And this allows him, the bodhisattva, him or her, to no longer experience social dysfunction and social suffering and to interact with others. So I think that when we do this, it sort of brings in what I want to be kind of the reoccurring themes of my book. It shows the way that compassion is not only other-centered, but it stabilizes the bodhisattva's own experience, both the mentor experience, but also his or her social experience, and is conducive to his own well-being or her own well-being or happiness in reality. In ordinary
yeah. reality, society. Yes, yeah. So moving on to wisdom, I think wisdom is something which is kind of discussed as something which is not only the aspect of the act of the volitional aspect of human being, but also at the same time the bodily act, and also at the same time the mental objects that are there, right? The objects that are outside of us. So, I mean, can you elaborate more on the Shantideva's understanding of wisdom here? Yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much for this very difficult question. The chapter 9 of Shantideva's guide is notoriously difficult. And this is another chapter where about, we know from the work of previous scholars, about half of the chapter was at a later date. This is true of chapter 8 and chapter 9. So I struggle the most with chapter 9, partially because of the abstruseness and the terseness of its philosophical argumentation. Organizationally, you know, it feels like the hardest chapter to me to deal with. So it's been interpreted a number of different ways. And, you know, it's for the book, I try to be relatively conservative about this. I present what I'm doing as a partial study of Shantideva's 9th chapter. So I leave unanalyzed, these are very important, analyzed in my book, his disputes with members of other Indian Buddhist and non-Buddhist schools. And also, I don't treat essentially his account of ultimate reality of itself or his account of Nirvana. This comes into the text. I mean, I have to mention this. But what I'm particularly interested in is the relation of wisdom to the other themes of my text, the development of his other, of the other virtuous mental states I've treated, and virtuous character, and this theme of the happiness of the developing Nirvana, bracketing for the most part in my book his account of final happiness or final Nirvana. It's an important topic, but it's one that isn't the central focus of my study. So given those various clarifications, what's the account of wisdom that I focus on? And again, I think this is something that he's deeply indebted to other Buddhist thinkers for. We find a lot of these positions in Chandrakirti, for instance, in his interpretation of Nagarjuna, but he claims that wisdom is the realization of the emptiness of intrinsic existence or essence of all beings. And his claim is that when we recognize and when we perceive objects, our own experience, and other beings as empty of essence, this eliminates all, totally and fully, all other pathological emotions. And so we've seen pieces of this throughout the text. And even in some of my descriptions, I mean, dependent origination is an aspect of wisdom. I talked about dependent origination when I talked about his arguments and treatments against anger. But here in Anatman or metaphysical selflessness is part of his argument for the irrationality of selfishness in chapter 8. But here in the wisdom chapter, this is where it becomes the absolute focus. And so I develop in the chapter, I emphasize a shared concern he has with many of the other, not just Majjhimaka and Yogacara, but also early Buddhist thinkers, that Buddhist accounts of metaphysical selflessness and emptiness will over-negate and destroy conventional reality and the possibility of spiritual practice. So he considers this centrally, and he gives an answer that was first developed by Nagarjuna, and that's that to say something's conventionally existent doesn't mean that it's non-existent. It means that it's causally dependent. It can't be found upon analysis, but it still functions when unanalyzed. And so what we get out of this when we take a look at what he does in the chapter as a whole is the Bodhisattva continues to relate to conventional reality, towards beings, towards the objects of compassion, continues to function with, at least for much of the path, a conventional sense of identity, but no longer reifies identity, no longer reifies those he or she experiences. And as a result, his or her experience of the world and others is globally transformed in a way that doesn't negate existence, but in a way that frees him or her of pathological emotions. So that's what I try to lay out in chapter 9. It's a way of completing the work that all of the other perfections have already done without negating the work they do of perfecting the Bodhisattva's virtuous character and progress on the path of the Bodhisattva.
Yeah. Interesting. So is there any other aspects of the book that which we haven't discussed you think that is important to be brought out and kind of talked about? Yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much for that question. Maybe one thing to mention, hopefully the book will make the case, and I hope the kind of our podcast discussion will help to make it. But I mean, you know, I think sometimes when moving towards a text like Shantideva's Guide, you know, it's sort of natural to wonder, was this a religious text? Was this a spiritual text? Was this a philosophical text? The answer is all three. I mean, absolutely, you know, these go perfectly together for Shantideva. And the reason, or one of the core reasons for this, I think one is quite distinctive to him, although there's this rich, as you know, there's a rich tradition of epistemological and metaphysical discussion by Buddhist philosophers, but there's less explicit, systematical, ethical argumentation. There's more psychology, there's therapeutic meditative techniques, there's a lot of philosophical work that happens. Shantideva is the, certainly not only, but the most prominent place where just explicit philosophical argumentation is a core piece of his method. And so one of the things when we do, and this helps place him globally in terms of philosophical conversations, it makes him an ally, for instance, of the Stoics, who also use argumentation to craft character. The negative emotions, the pathological emotions arise because of a misperception of reality. And so intellectual argumentation is not the only, but an important tool to at least begin to attenuate mistakes. We become better by arguing more clearly and reasoning more clearly about reality. And so this is why I think for philosophers who may not have spent a lot of time with Buddhist texts, don't be discouraged by what's the explicitly spiritual and religious tone of this text. Absolutely, soteriology is a natural category to approach the text with, but philosophical argumentation, you know, a kind of rigorous, interesting philosophical argumentation is a central tool in which, you know, the Bodhisattva develops his or her virtuous character. And then the last thing I'll say is, like all philosophers, you know, I'm sort of drawn to certain parts of the text where this explicit philosophical voice comes out. But yeah, you know, I think for the last 15, 20 years, the people writing in Buddhist ethics, like Charles Goodman, I've mentioned, Emily McRae's, another really great person, Jay Garfield has done this, you know, really point out that not only explicit argumentation, but this conception of value that Shantideva gives and that Shantideva deconstructs, you know, so his attention to dissatisfactory aspects of ordinary experience, his repeated allusion to, you know, dukkha or various forms of suffering, his description of mental experience. I mean, this also does argumentative work, even when it's not in syllogistic form. So what I'm hoping to kind of move towards with this book is the idea of taking Shantideva seriously for his arguments, for his explicit kind of arguments that that take a much more syllogistic form, but also seeing the whole text as a series of interconnected contemplations and argumentations that give a powerful conception of human experience, its value, and what impoverishes it. The whole thing is philosophy, is what I'm trying to say with too many words.
Yeah, but I think this is a very interesting philosophical take on the guide to the practices of awakening by Shantideva, I think. And because of time constraint, we have to end the discussion here, but I think there are so many things to discuss. And I hope the listeners have got at least the argument of the things, the argument that is there in the book. And also the listeners will go back and look at the book and, you know, delve into the topics much more deeper and the philosophical argumentation that is going on and how Shantideva thinks about this aspect of well-being and its relation to virtue that is there. So Dr. Harris has explained this very well, and the book is also very well written. So thank you very much for that. So if anyone wants to reach out to you regarding the book, which is the best way to reach out to you? Yeah.
Probably the easiest thing to do is just Google Stephen Harris on Leiden, and my website will pop up with my email account. And just send me an email. I'd love to hear from you, any thoughts you have on the book, any additional resources. And really, I just want to thank you so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun, and I'm really grateful to have been able to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Harris, for being here at New Books Network. Yeah.